Good morning. There we go. Loretta is making more copies of the sheets. For those who I haven't met before, I'm Mordechai Torchiner, and welcome to The Pursuit of Peace, a three-part series. Hopefully we'll talk about peace in the home this week, and then peace among Jews next week. And then once we solve those problems, peace in the greater world in week three, and that'll be that. We'll have solved all the world's problems, or not. I know that that some of you signed in and registered with Loretta in advance. If you haven't yet, please make sure that she has your email address, because I'd like to be able to email out information in addition to the class, the source sheets in advance of the class, as well as the fact that we record audio for the classes, and I upload it so that you can download it in the event that you miss a week or just want to relive the greatest hits. So in order to get the audio, you need to be on the email list. Also, one other request, if you have a cell phone and you are able to put it on mute or vibrate or some such thing, please do so. I'll also note that following this class, there is a second one, 11:15 to 12:15, by Rabbi Jonathan Ziering. He is speaking about playing God, and I believe his topic this week is choosing the gender of a baby. Then he's going to move on to cloning and to GMO foods. So that should be interesting as well. Okay. Peace in the home. What's the term for that in Hebrew? Anybody know?
Shalom
bayit. Excellent. I am very glad to hear that people know the term. That's a very good thing. I won't ask how many of us achieve it, but at least knowing the name for it is a step. Shalom bayit, indeed, is considered a great priority within Judaism. We'll see more about that as we go along. But I want to begin by looking at two biblical wedding blessings. Take a look, please, at the first source on your sheet. The first wedding blessing found in the Torah. This is the story of Rivka and Rebecca. Recall how this works, right? Abraham and Sarah have a son, Yitzhak, Isaac. After Sarah has passed away, Abram sends his servant off to the family in a land called Aram, saying, go find a wife for Yitzchak, for Isaac, from the family. And this servant goes there, meets her at the well. She is very generous. She offers water not just for him, but also for the camels. And he's very impressed by her. And then he finds out she's from the family, which means he can check off that box as well on his list. And he says to her, will you come marry Yitzhak? Will you marry Isaac? And she says, of course, because as you read about her family in the story, you understand exactly why she wants to get far from there. And then they wait overnight, and then in the morning when she's supposed to go, they ask her, are you going to go? Because the family doesn't want to send her yet. And they ask her, and she says, Eilech, I will go. And at that point you get source number one. And they, her family, blessed Rebecca and said to her, our sister, may you become thousands and myriads, and may your child conquer the gates of his enemies. That's the bracha, that's the blessing that Rivka's family gives her. What does that tell you about them? What does that tell you about their values? Sorry? Family is very important. Clearly they want grandchildren. Lineage is important. What else?
They consider themselves high up in the stratification.
Why?
Well, you will be light unto the world.
Well, it didn't say anything about being a light unto the world.
That's part of you're going to be the future.
Well, right now, all I see is that you should become many, thousands and myriads, and strong. They're scared. They're scared. This is the blessing that you're giving your daughter as you send her off to get married. That your child should conquer the gates of his enemies. That suggests that there are enemies out there, right? This is a scary picture of the world. The world is a great and dangerous place, and you should conquer your enemies. Now, mind you, that's not exclusive to them. That's a common theme biblically. We are the good, and everybody else are potentially immoral, dangerous. If you think about it, right, Abraham and Sarah, they travel from Aram. They're from that part of the woods. And they travel to Canaan, and there's a famine, and they descend to Egypt, and they're concerned, what are we going to find in Egypt? These people are immoral people. They may kidnap Sarah. Like, this is a common concern. The idea that where we live in our shtetl, to use a word that completely doesn't apply at that point in history, but in our shtetl we are good, but in the rest of the world we don't know what's going on. We're concerned, and therefore, you should merit that your children should conquer their enemies. That's one blessing. Then you get a second one in source number 2, and this is from the book of Ruth. To bring the entire story in capsule form, there's a famine in Israel. A woman named Naomi and her husband Elimelech and their two sons run away from Beit Lechem where they had lived. They go off to Moab. There's great symbolism in them going to Moab because Moab is rooted in stinginess, people who don't want to help others. That's the identity of Moab throughout the biblical record. So they say, we're going to go away from where everybody is in need and we're going to go off to Moab. And they live in Moab, and they have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, who marry Moabite women. One of them marries Ruth, and the two sons die, and Elimelech dies, and Naomi comes back at that point to Israel. She's going to come back home to Beit Lechem. She has her two daughters-in-law with her, Orpah and Ruth. She says to them, there's no point in you coming back there with me. You don't know anybody. Frankly, you're Moabites, and Moabites are not exactly welcome over in Israel. And I can't produce other children who you will ultimately be able to marry. There is no concept of you staying within the family. So look, you're better off being here. And Orpah listens to her, says that makes a lot of sense, and goes her own way. And Ruth says, I'm going to stay with you. Your nation is my nation. Wherever you go, I will go. This beautiful poem of accepting Naomi and accepting Naomi's people as her own. And she returns. They, through events that we're not going to go into, end up meeting up with Boaz, who is a distant relative, and Ruth is set up to marry Boaz. And that brings us to number 2. The verse at their wedding, the entire nation at the gate, and the elders, there's one other line preceding this that I should mention. Boaz turns to the people at the gate, and he says, you are to be witnesses that I am marrying her today. So that's where this comes in. The entire nation at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May God make the woman who is entering your home like Rachel and Leah, the two of whom built the house of Israel. May you amass wealth in Ephrata and call your name in Beit Lechem, Bethlehem. It's a nice blessing. Do you see anything that stands out about it?
Well, she's not Jewish.
At this point she is, right? She has given her speech to Naomi, your nation is my nation, where you go, I will go, where you die, I will, the whole bit.
She doesn't say anything about increasing, about having children.
Right. Right, maybe if you say she should be like Rachel and Leah who built up the house of Israel, maybe that's a little more subtle than you should become thousands and myriads. So maybe there's that, but you're right, there isn't an emphasis on that. The Ephrata is the location. We call it Ephrat. There's a lot of discussion about the city of Ephrat when they founded it, whether it should be named Ephrata or should be named Ephrat. But Ephrata is the original name. But the May You part is actually the blessing they're giving to Boaz, who is marrying Ruth. If you look in one of the problems with translating Hebrew to English is that pronouns lose gender in English. You, me, we, I, these don't have gender attached to them. In the Hebrew, that's male, starting with may you. So really the part that's addressing Ruth is the first part of it saying, and it's really, even there, it's speaking to Boaz. Boaz talked to them, and they say back to Boaz, may God make this woman who was entering your house, may God make Ruth like Rachel and Leah. Sorry? Yes. So a couple of points are raised here. First of all, we're picking Rachel and Leah to the exclusion of Sarah, to the exclusion of Rebecca, to the exclusion of Bilhah and Zilpah. There's something about Rachel and Leah that we are picking up on here. And the note that Rachel and Leah are not exactly in the happiest of situations for most of their married life. Right? Jacob thinks he's marrying Rachel. It turns out he's marrying Leah. He ends up marrying Rachel also, but Rachel feels like she's being shoved behind Leah as Leah has more children than she has none. Leah is upset because Jacob prefers Rachel. It's really a, you know, you could have picked a happier dynamic, potentially. As opposed to the Rachel and Leah one, yes?
But they're actually emphasizing building the house of Israel.
Right.
It's not so much their internal relationships that is being emphasized. It's the fact that they were the mothers of Israel.
Right. The emphasis, good, is on the national role. The emphasis is on the fact that at this point, this is when the Jewish people take off with Rachel and Leah. Bilhah and Zilpah are given to Yaakov by Rachel and Leah, and therefore they're an outgrowth of Rachel and Leah. That's its own story, which we could spend a year on. But the emphasis is on building up a nation. That's the association with Rachel and Leah, just like they built up the house of Israel. So we see you have a blessing of insecurity from the family of Rebekah. We want you to become many and conquer your enemies. And you have this blessing given to Ruth, which is, we would like you to be able to build up build up a nation just as Rachel and Leah built up a nation. There's very much this eye towards the future. There's an eye towards building a legacy. Diane. Interesting. Is there a foreshadowing? It's true that she is the matriarch who leads to David, who leads to Mashiach, the whole messianic line is from her. Can we see foreshadowing here? Well, I guess in the sense that she will build up the house of Israel. So from that perspective, yes. We actually use both of these blessings. If you go to a traditional wedding, in the beginning, before the chuppah, you have to show up earlier, right? There is a badeken.
Yes.
So at the badeken, there is a bracha, there's a blessing traditionally given by the father of the kala, the father of the bride, to the bride. And that blessing takes both of these blessings, both one from source number one and the one from source number two. He says to his daughter, may you become thousands and myriads. They skip the may your child conquer the gate of his enemies, interestingly, perhaps because we don't really want to talk about enemies at the time of a wedding, love one's family notwithstanding. We prefer to skip the enemies part. So what we say is, may you become thousands and myriads, and then skip to source number two, may God make her like Rachel and Leah, who built up the house of Israel. So we actually use this as part of a wedding ceremony to flourish and to build up that legacy. However, there's another blessing that is used that's not directly biblical. It has a biblical association, which I'll explain in a moment, but it's not directly biblical as a wedding blessing. When you hear news about a couple getting engaged, it's traditional to wish them that they should. Anybody know? Sorry? Something with a bayit, yeah? Not shalom. Right. That they should build a bayis ne'eman, a bayit ne'eman, b'Yisrael. Whether you pronounce it bayit ne'eman or bayis ne'eman, either way. What does that mean? What is a bayit ne'eman? So it means an enduring house. The word ne'eman can mean faithful, but it doesn't in this context. If you take a look at source number three, you see one biblical verse that uses this phrase. We see it elsewhere as well. But I brought you this one, where God says, I will establish for myself an enduring priest, when he will act in accord with my heart and will, meaning someone who will last. This comes from a passage in which God rejects the priest, Eli, because his two sons have become abusive of their power as priests in the temple. And so God says, I am rejecting this line. I will establish for myself an enduring priest when he will act in accord with my heart and will. I will build an enduring house for him. And that is a Bayit Ne'eman, an enduring house. So the message is that we give people a blessing when they get engaged, that they should build a Bayit Ne'eman, they should build an enduring house in Israel. Yes, Dalia.
When the temple still existed, we didn't have rabbis, so people just got buried in their villages with what?
Okay. So Dalia asks a great question. How exactly did this happen? So a couple of points. First, you did have rabbis in temple times. And there is this historical question of at what point they take over the central figure from the priests. But even before you have rabbis separate from the Kohanim, separate from the priesthood, the priests function in a rabbinic role. In other words, their job is to teach. Their job is to spread Torah. It's the same role. The only question is it by this caste or is it broader? But that's one point. But the other is that, and maybe I ought not to say this, but you don't actually need a rabbi for a wedding. A Jewish wedding is valid 100% without a rabbi presence. You may need someone who knows what they're doing. Yeah, but that's really all that's needed. A Jewish wedding requires kosher witnesses and a minyan. That's it. And you have to do the rituals. But that's all you need. A rabbi is not required. Yeah, fine. We need them too. The question of how it would be done, it would have been the same. There is no such requirement. So we see here, first in the biblical blessings, and then in the popular blessing of Bayit Ne'eman B'Yisrael, to build an enduring home, this concern for, once again, a legacy, something that will last. And so the question is, how do you do that? How exactly are we supposed to build this Bayit Ne'eman? How do you build this house of Israel that we're talking about? And everyone will have their own answers. And one may say, well, it's all about having a date night once a week. Or someone else may give some other practical answer. But take a look at source number 4. That's an answer. So if you take a look at source number 4, this is from the very end of the Mishnah. Remember, that Mishnah is the first recorded version of the Jewish oral tradition. You have this biblical text the Jews have had with them from the beginning. It comes along with a verbal explanation, which is passed along generation to generation. When they finally write it down, for reasons we have discussed, they write this down, concluding it in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. That first outline that's written down is the Mishnah. This is the end of the Mishnah. It comes with a nice, happy ending. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta said, God did not find a receptacle to hold blessing for Israel other than peace. If you want to know how blessing will be maintained, all the blessings that one may have, whether that's wealth, whether that's children, whatever it is, all of the blessings that one receives will only be held in the receptacle that is peace. How do I know that? They draw it from a verse in Psalms. God will give his nation strength. God will bless his nation with peace. And the idea is that the strength that God gives is the blessing, and the peace is what makes it endure. And from this we have the idea that whatever blessings one has, whatever fine things one has, whether those are objects or whether those are something more spiritual, whatever it is, if a person has shalom, if a person has peace, it will endure. And if they have strife, it will fall apart. That's the core idea. And so when we talk about having a bayit ne'eman, an enduring house, when we talk about receiving these blessings that are listed here, the way to do it is through peace. I don't think that's novel. I don't think that's, yeah, I mean, the sources maybe, but the idea of it, I think, is you know, relatively common idea. But this becomes one of the most basic pillars of Judaism. If you take a look at source number 5, this is from the work Pirkei Avot, which is part of the Mishnah. It's actually the very second lesson in Pirkei Avot. It is attributed to Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous. And he said, the world stands on 3 things. Torah, Avodah, service of God, and Gvilut Chasadim, generosity. Torah, service of God, and generosity. Now, when he says the world stands on 3 things, what does that mean? The foundation. They're what make everything possible, but these are also going to be central categories from which everything else descends. These are supposed to be the pillars of what Judaism is offering the world. Torah. I brought you a line in source number 6, which probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense in a vacuum. So let me explain it a little bit. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in his work, The Emergence of Ethical Man, points out something fascinating about creation. If you go back to the beginning of the biblical text, looking at the role of the human being, is a human being created in a way that's different from the animal?
I hope so.
Yes. We got to do more than hope. In what way, if you look back at the biblical account of creation, in what way is the human being different from the animal? Yes, Steve.
Right and wrong. Adam.
Well, that's not in the creation, right? Eventually, he's told a right and wrong. He's given an instruction, right? Don't eat from the tree. That worked out well. Dahlia.
Male or female, except for Adam alone.
All of the other species are created... It seems like all the other species are created male and female, but Adam is not, except that when you look at the first account of the creation of Adam, it says indeed he's created male and female, which is why the Talmud suggests Chava is there from the beginning, and that's its own story that I'm not going to be able to go into right now. Yes? Free will? Is that there in creation?
No.
Right. It's certainly implied, but it's only implied after he's created when you get a command. Because you can't command someone to do something or not do something unless they have the ability to make that decision. Otherwise, yeah, and of course the proof of it is the fact that they eat from the fruit. If you don't have free will, how'd you end up eating? Yes? They're given control over the world. But that's also not at the moment that they're created.
Image?
Naseh Adam b'tzalmenu kidmuteinu, let us make man in the image we have designated for him. Yes, you don't find language like that with the animals. That is the moment at which you see a distinction. That's where the distinction starts. But the question is still, what does that mean to be in God's image? Marilyn.
I think a higher level of intelligence. We don't... Well...
Better make sure the dolphins don't hear you.
I said I was... Sometimes higher level of intelligence. I mean, animals are intelligent, we know, but this is a higher level so that we can make decisions.
Could be.
We're born with them.
Right. Possible. Possible, but in terms of the creation story, I mean, what I'm going to say actually fits into the intelligence and decision-making a little bit. It's striking, and this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's point, it's striking that the same language, the same words are used for creation of the plants and creation of the animals and much of the creation of the human being. It talks about creating them from the dirt and creating the human being, afar min ha'adama, dirt from the ground. It talks about how all the different species, the plants and the animals, are created liminehu, according to their kind, according to their species. And they are blessed, pru urvu, you should bear fruit and you should multiply. Same terms are used when it comes to the human being. The moment when the human being is differentiated from the animal is when God turns to Adam and the Torah says, Vayitzav. Vayitzav means... And he commanded, from the word mitzvah, right? He commanded. It's the moment when God gives an instruction. God speaks to the animals he created also. But there it's Vayomer. He makes a statement. This shall be. To command suggests that you're speaking to somebody with some kind of relationship who will hear what you say and make an ethical decision. And so if you take a look at source number 6, now you see Rabbi Soloveitchik's statement about this moment of Vayitzav. God takes man-animal, which is what we are until that point, into his confidence, addresses him, and reveals to him his moral will. That is the very moment when human beings become something different. And that is what, in our Mishnah, in source number 5, in Pirkei Avot, is meant by Torah. When he says the world stands on 3 things, and one of them is Torah, what he means is, that which separates the human being from the animal, having a relationship with God in which God is going to say, this is what I want, and the human being is called upon to act on that basis, to make that decision. That's your first pillar of the world, is the nature of the human being in this relationship with God. The second one is avoda, service of God, taking that relationship further, in which the human being is going to express gratitude to God, and say, how can I, in fact, perform his will? What is it that God wants of me, and how can I do it? But then we get to the third. And the third is gemilut chasadim, the idea of helping others. And I brought you a couple of quotes that I just love on this point. One, Rabbi Yitzhak of Volozhin. I don't remember if I've used this in one of the classes here yet, and if you've heard it from me before. If you have, bear with me. Rabbi Yitzhak of Volozhin lives in the beginning of the 19th century. His father is Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin. If you've ever heard of the Vilna Gaon?
Yes.
Okay, the Vilna Gaon is considered to be the giant of the Lithuanian Jewish world for the last several centuries. Just an outstanding, outstanding mind. And Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin was his top student. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin founded a yeshiva called the Volozhin Yeshiva, appropriately enough, and it was considered the greatest of the yeshivot, the greatest of the Torah academies of Europe, again, in the last several centuries. The entrance exam, this is your entrance exam, it is said, was something called the pin test. In the pin test, you would take a volume of the Talmud and put a pin through it. And the job of the student taking the exam was to tell the examiner what word the pin would have gone through on each page. The pin test. It's not impossible. I've seen it done. But, yeah, it's pretty near. This is a yeshiva that is dedicated to academic excellence. It was not meant to be an academy for everybody who wants to learn. It was meant to generate leaders. It was meant to generate the highest scholars. And so I might look at this yeshiva, founded by Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, and think, so what's their focus going to be out of those three? Torah for sure, service of God for sure. That's what I would look at. Take a look at source number 7 now. This is the preface to Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin's book, Nefesh HaChaim. And it's written by his son, Rabbi Yitzhak of Volozhin, a great scholar in his own right. And he says, my father always used to rebuke me as he saw that I would not take part in the pain of others. This is what he always told me. This is a person's entire purpose. A person is not created for himself. A person is created only to benefit others with whatever power is in his possession. You're talking about the height of academia, the most intellectually focused. But they understood that the core message isn't about the study. The core message is, what are you doing for other people? And that's why I like this quote so much, because of where it's coming from. I wouldn't have expected it from this source, and lo and behold, there it is. This is what he remembers of his father's advice. And I brought a similar idea in source number 8, from Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz. Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz was something known as the Mashgiach Ruchani of the Mir Yeshiva in the beginning of the 20th century. The Mir Yeshiva, also known as a prominent academy of Torah in Poland, Lithuania, in the beginning of the 20th century, still exists, now it's in Israel. Rabbi Lubavitz was the Mashgiach Ruchani. Mashgiach Ruchani means, essentially, spiritual guide. Spiritual guide. And this is from a book of his, Da'at Chachma Musar, and he says, the issue of bearing the yoke with others, bearing the burdens of others, is so great, because this is the entire Torah, meaning the joining of souls to feel each other's feelings. All of Torah study, all of the learning, and all of the deeds, the final goal is that all souls should be joined to feel each other's feelings, to truly be one. Empathy for others. That's what he is trying to tell the students, again, in this very rigorous intellectual academy. This is our focus. So we have three overall pillars of Judaism, and pillars of the world, we're told. There's Torah, the ability of the human being to have this connection to God and be told this is what God wants you to do. There is Avodah, that is service of God. And then there is Gemilut Chasadim, kindness to others, the bond with other people. These play out, these three play out in a Jewish law which you may be familiar with. I hope you're familiar with the principle of pikuach nefesh, saving a life. Right? We say that, generally speaking, saving lives overrides almost all of Judaism. What does it not override? Adultery is one of them. What else?
Murder.
I mean, it's there on the sheet. Take a look at source number 9. Passage from the Talmud. Nothing stands before saving a life other than these three: idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder. Those are the three for which we're told, no, you can't do that even to save a life. There's a potential fourth, but I'm not going to go there right now. It's more complicated. But what you see here is parallel to those big three. Murder, the importance of the human being. Torah, the ability of the human being to rise above the animal. Idolatry, the importance of recognizing God and serving God. And then sexual immorality, and the importance of community. Because in general, that is looked at as the concern involved in immorality is that it undermines the relationships that build community. And so, I come to the point of what we're saying now. Shalom Bayit, this principle of peace in the home, is given such a great role within Judaism, and we'll see how great in a moment, because the home is the most basic building block of that third pillar. The home is the most basic building block of tzibur, of community. Without it, you won't have the gemilut chasadim, the kindness to others. That is one of the pillars. It is on a level with the other two, Torah and service of God. And if we want to build a home that endures, then that's what we're going to need. In order to build this Bayit Ne'eman B'Yisrael, this enduring home, we're going to need that shalom, that peace that maintains all blessing. Clear? Okay. Let me take that a step further now. Anyone familiar with the concept of Shana Rishona? Anybody hear that phrase? Yeah. What is it? Sorry? Right. The concept that the bride and groom stay in their home together for the first year. Take a look at source number 10, please. This is from a book called Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch seeks to outline the 613 commandments, because we're told in the Talmud that there are, in fact, 613. So he seeks to list all 613 and give a couple of paragraphs about each one. So mitzvah number 582. He says, we are commanded that a groom should rejoice with his wife for 1 year, meaning that he should not leave the city for war or other pursuits to live apart from her for many days. The reason why he spells out war is because that's the biblical context in which the mitzvah is presented. When it talks about who goes to war, it specifically excludes the groom. So that's why he singles it out here. And he says, the groom doesn't leave the city to live apart from her for many days. Rather, he should live with her for a full year from the wedding. And he says, regarding this, Deuteronomy 24:5 says, this is the original verse, he shall be free to his house for 1 year, and he shall gladden the wife he has wed. No word on what if she's not happy about having him around the house, right? I've heard about that.
A lot of marriages before divorce.
Maybe, yes. But that's a key message. The message that he should just stay home to be with her. As a matter of fact, Sefer HaChinuch goes on to make a very interesting observation. Right after this, in his very next paragraph, I didn't bring it because I wanted to fit everything else on the page. But he goes on to say that if they don't have this time together, they don't develop a normal with each other. The idea that their relationship with each other is supposed to be what's normal. You want to develop a normal of this is who we are, this is how we live. Recognize and become familiar with each other's habits, hopefully in a positive way. If you don't have that time, then the result can be that as they travel in the world, they meet other people and they decide, well, I like this one or I like that one. This way, by developing this relationship as the normal, everything else seems foreign. It's a way to establish this and make everything else foreign and different, and hopefully, the goal is, less appealing to them. That's his psychological observation. But the basic principle is for them to be alone together for a year in order to build their bonds with each other at the very outset of their marriage. But it plays out beyond that. Take a look, please, at source number 11. From the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. A woman may keep her husband from going to distant places on business so that he will not fail to observe Onah, and he may only go with her permission. Now, Onah, for anyone who's not aware, Onah is... The Torah outlines three basic obligations that a man has to his wife. One is She'er, the second is Ksut, the third is Onah. She'er is the obligation to feed her, and food includes medicine, it includes a range of things that come under that heading. Ksut is clothing, which includes shelter, and Onah is sexual relations. Those are the three obligations that he has to her. So, in source number 11, he says, the wife is able to keep the husband from traveling far away. Even if he says, well, I need it for business to support the family, he's only allowed to go if she permits it. Now, once again, sometimes the wife may say, I'm fed up with having you at home. That's another story. But she has the option of saying, no, I'm not letting you go on that trip. If you flip the page, you take a look at source number 12. Also from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, but you find different statements from the Sephardic part, authored by Rabbi Yosef Karo, and Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow, the Ashkenazi part. Rabbi Karo, who's writing in Israel, says, where a husband wishes to give his wife her appropriate food and have her eat on her own, he may, so long as he eats with her on Friday night. Friday night, you have to eat together. But other than that, you just make sure she has food, and that's it. All jokes about Sephardim aside. I'm not going there. Someone up here says that's a happy marriage. Rabbi Isserles provides the Ashkenazi response, and he says some disagree, contending that he may not tell her to eat alone unless she agrees of her own will, and so appears correct to me. He says, no, it's up to her to decide whether they have family dinner or not. And this is not within that first year. This is throughout the marriage. If she says, I want you to be home for dinner, then he is obligated to be home for dinner. That's the statement.
Seriously?
I actually usually am. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I'm on record saying that. Yes. This is in... Yeah, number 12 is within the Shulchan Aruch section, the Code of Jewish Law section, that discusses the mitzvah of providing her with food. because we said that there are these three obligations, so it has different sections to talk about what's included within each of them. So this is in the one about food. These measures are here as a means of building up peace within the home. The idea is that you build the relationship. And despite all of the jokes about will being around each other increase peace or damage it, the ideal vision is that being around each other will create bonds that will strengthen the marriage and the home. That's the goal. Yeah, look, Judaism is all about aspirations. That's who we are. Go further with it, though. Take a look, please, at source number 13. This is a controversial piece. You know, in general, I was very concerned because usually I like to give classes on topics that, you know, like there are multiple sides, but it's really hard to debate. No, I'm against peace in the home. But here's one that you can sink your teeth into. Lying to somebody in order to maintain peaceful relationships. In other words, you're better off not knowing. Do you remember when that movie came out, My Big Fat Greek Wedding?
Yeah.
And how many elements of that were mirror images of things in the Jewish community? Including that one, the issue of the wife telling the husband what he needs to know, but not telling him what she feels he does not need to know. Yeah. Okay, just checking. So take a look at source number 13. Passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Elah taught, citing Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, one may deviate, and when he said the term in Hebrew, l'shanot, means to change, as in to change the truth, for the sake of peace. And he quotes a biblical verse. He quotes it from the end of the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis. If you remember the story, by chance, Joseph's brothers sold him. Sound familiar? Right, they sell him as a slave. He ends up becoming the viceroy of Egypt. He brings his whole family down to support them there during the famine. Everybody is good until Jacob passes away. And at that point, the brothers are scared. Maybe the only reason Joseph hasn't taken revenge is because their father's alive. And now, the floodgates will open. He has us in his power. And so they come to Joseph and they lie to him. And that's what you see here. Joseph's brothers said to him, "Your father instructed, so shall you say to Joseph, please forgive the sin of your brothers." There was no such conversation. It's even debated whether Jacob ever knew about how things had happened. There are those who argue that they kept him in the dark. In other words, when the question came up of, "So Joseph, how did you end up in Egypt?" They just sort of changed the subject. But it is clear, we don't have any record of any such conversation, and what the Talmud is saying is, they were lying, and this is acceptable. In order to maintain peace between them, better to let them think that their father had expressed this wish. That's one. Second, Rabbi Nathan taught, not only are you allowed to, he says it is a mitzvah to do so. And he quotes a verse from Shmuel, the book of Samuel. Samuel had to do something that's a real no-no in the Middle East. Right? One of the things you should never do in the Middle East is name a new king while the old king is still alive. Bad idea. But that's what he had to do. Saul is still alive, and God wants to coronate King David. And so he sends Samuel, to go name David as the king. And Samuel says what you see here. Samuel said, "How will I go to anoint David? Saul will hear and kill me." And as the verse continues, God says to him, no, tell him that you're going to do something else, and that way he won't realize what's going on. God says to him, don't do it. Don't tell him exactly what you're doing. Better to lie. Now, you could argue that in both of these cases, it's not really about lying for peace. What's it really about? It's not about peace at all. Self-serving isn't quite strong enough. They're lying to save their lives. Yeah. Well, I'm just hurting someone. It's lying to save his life. If you tell Saul, "I have come to anoint someone who's going to take over for you," that conversation isn't going to go well. The brothers are afraid that Joseph is going to have them, I don't know what terrible fate they imagine, but something suitable for people who, you know, sold their brothers as a slave. This is self-preservation. So I'm not sure I would prove from these cases that you're allowed to lie just to keep the peace. But then you look at the third one, in number 13. It was taught in the school of Rabbi Yishmael, peace is so great that even God lied for its sake. And he refers you to the story in which Abraham and Sarah are told, you are going to have a son. Remember, they have the three visitors come to their tent, Abraham welcomes them in, and so on. And Sarah hears the report that she's going to have a child, and she laughs and says, I can't have a child. Vadoni zaken. She says, I am too old. After I've already worn out, she says, am I going to be rejuvenated? Vadoni zaken. And by the way, my husband over there is old too. Which, you know, he's 100 years old. I mean, he is. Okay? There's time when you have to just sort of live with it. Or he's not 100 yet. He's 99. Maybe he thinks next year I'll be old. But she says, how can it be? And she laughs at this news. And God comes to Abraham and says to him, why did Sarah laugh, saying, I am old? The line there. But God later reported that she had said, and I am old. God goes to Abraham, he goes to Abraham and criticizes the laughter. He tells Abraham that because you have to remember, in their relationship, Abraham is the Navi. He's the prophet of God. All through their career, even though Sarah is considered to be the one who has a greater natural understanding of what God wants, if you look at the story of evicting Ishmael from the home, Abraham is told, listen to your wife. Nonetheless, God converses with Abraham, and Abraham tells Sarah what God has said when it comes to leaving their home and traveling to Canaan. In all these cases, God speaks to Abraham. He is the prophet. And so God comes to him and says, you're the prophet. You have to speak to Sarah about her ridicule of my statement. When I said she's going to have a child, it's inappropriate for her to mock what I said. So you have to talk to her about it. However, he changes what she said. He doesn't say, she called you old, Abraham. She said she's old. He softens it so that she won't be talking about Abraham. And so what the Talmud here is saying is that God intentionally altered it, he lied, in order to keep the peace between them. For or against lying for the sake of preserving peace? Moish. Four. We've got four. Four. Anybody against lying for the sake of peace?
Well, we could call it calling a story. It doesn't have to be a lie.
If we don't want to use the word lie, we can use whatever word we want, but when you change what somebody said, it's called lying.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is.
And by the way, Abraham laughed as well, and he doesn't.
Yes. I know.
Right, because his laughter is a laughter of, this is amazing. He doesn't voice a statement of, this can't happen. Hers is accompanied with this little speech about being old. Stephen, you were going to say?
No. Is there a difference of lying, being deception, or lying, not telling the whole truth? It's not the same thing.
I mean, God reported something that didn't happen. That's not hiding. You know, when we had our course on business ethics, right, we distinguished between not telling everything you know and giving the wrong impression, you know, actively. And we said there may be circumstances where you're not obligated to share what you know. If you spent on gaining expertise, so you aren't obligated to now share that expertise with the other side. You had something appraised, you spent on an appraisal, the person on the other side, the person selling it to you, doesn't realize what it's worth, so you don't have an obligation to tell him, well, I had it appraised and it's actually worth whatever. However, we said, you don't have the right to go to that person and say to him, I had it appraised and they said it's worth $5. That's an act of lie. And that's, you can't mistake it. It's not that, you know, if God wanted to just conceal, he could have not said what she said at all. But he actively said something that was in the opposite direction. Ruth?
Bye.
Yeah, absolutely. Ruth makes the point that if you don't tell the truth, you're not giving them the opportunity to deal with the situation properly and positively. And not only that, you're making the decision for them. Right? It's up to you. It sort of puts you in this kind of patronizing position of, well, I don't think they would deal with this well, so I think I just won't tell them. Right?
Okay.
1 second. You had,
yeah.
Why?
And secondly, I think that couples should have that kind of interference. I don't know how it's sounding as it's coming out, but yeah. Why didn't they work it out?
Right.
That's
so
nice,
right.
That we didn't work it out today.
Right. So it's a good point. I mean, the first question of if Abraham is a prophet, so then shouldn't he know what it was that she said is not necessarily so, because prophecy. There's some debate as to how prophecy is supposed to work, but the general tendency is to assume the prophet only gets the message God chooses to give. It's not that a prophet is just naturally tuned in to everything that's going on. But in terms of the latter question, is this really a healthy way to deal with a problem within a marriage? Is it best just for them not to know? I would have to say that in an ideal world, we all know about everything and deal with it positively. In a real world, we pick and choose where we want to do that. I think that's true. And not just in terms of reporting something that somebody said, but in terms of what we generally think inside versus what we express. We do filter. And that's not a bad thing, I think. Betty and then Sandy.
So if it's an important issue, of course, that's one thing. But if Sarah turns to Abraham and says, do I look fat in this shift, the correct answer would be no. You look lovely, because they're on their way out, and all the Jewish people are waiting for them, and that's just obvious. I mean, it's not going to change any major.
Is that the right answer?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. Yeah. I mean, but the other point that you mentioned that I didn't really grab, but it's true, is the question of what does this do to their family dynamic, Abraham playing the nubbin. In other words, when God doesn't have a lot of people to choose from. It's just, you know, these two followers. But at the same time, it has to be a very strange dynamic where one spouse is talking to God and bringing God's word to the other. And particularly when it's a rebuke. Yes, I have to say that sounds challenging. Sandy and then.
When you mentioned picking and choosing, while I understand the concept and I know it's applied quite frequently, I think it's starting with slippery slope. When is it that you choose to do this and when?
Yep.
I think it's very hard to differentiate all the different aspects of when and when not to do it, and I think that's where we get into trouble.
Right, and I think that's very true, but I think that's what life is. I mean, slippery slopes are everywhere, and we have to, unfortunately, tread carefully on them. One more, and then I'm going to just point something out with this. Yeah.
I think we need to go back to the word, because the word that you put on the sheet is deviate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the word deviate is that more direction. Stephen was saying at the beginning about, you know, there's certain modifications, if you want to use that word, of what happened that you might use to get a better